Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
From KUNC and the NPR Network, this is In the NoCo, a daily slice of Northern Colorado news and happenings. It's Wednesday, April 10th. I'm Erin O'Toole. Have you ever wondered how NPR came to be? Well, it certainly didn't happen overnight. The history of National Public Radio is long and convoluted, starting in the early 20th century with stations scattered across rural areas, broadcasting things like cooking lessons and how to use indoor plumbing. But the Communications Act of 1934 first gave congressional control over what was heard over the airwaves, and it meant public broadcasting needed to evolve.
Public media is the last bastion in reporting upon communities from the communities itself. So I think that we need to protect our local public medias, especially our rural public medias.
Josh Shepard is a media historian and professor at the University of Colorado Boulder. He chronicles much of this early history of public radio in his new book, Shadow of the New Deal. I sat down with him to talk about what public radio sounded like 100 years ago and how Western states like Colorado helped create the NPR name. So before NPR was even conceived, our country had local stations housed in universities. Often these were in rural areas where people were pretty remote from what might have been considered the culture of big city life. You write in the book's introduction, and I absolutely love this quote. There was a visitor from the BBC who was involved and who noted that in the 1930s, U.S. educational media was received less as a parallel to the BBC than as a ramshackle assemblage of Midwestern university employees filling the airwaves with monotone lectures, poorly staged drama, and disorganized instruction. Josh, could you talk about what the public radio experience was like in those early years?
Yeah. So, you know, early public radio, which would have been called educational radio back then, was really an extension service for what we would call distance learning. And there were just simply audiences that couldn't be reached in rural communities in particular, and especially out west, and especially in the Midwest. The early, you know, educators that were using radio for education had no idea how to use the aesthetics of radio. They had no idea how to speak to the audience in the way that radio asks. So a lot of the 1920s and 30s was a trial and error and experimental moment by which they were just trying to develop what we would now call like a genre of public broadcasting to reach those audiences so that they could have equal access to education. So you get like home economics becomes cooking shows, history broadcasts, language, business.
Yeah. Now, in a recent talk you gave, you discussed this burgeoning network of small stations, and you said the heroes here are the smaller towns who care about building community. I'm wondering if you could expand on that a little bit, building community. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, so one thing I love about public radio, and one of the reasons I wrote the book, is because it's essentially a mission statement-based approach to media. There's no profit logic. There's no advertising, hypothetically. It really is an attempt that everyone has equal access to the same information, to the same education, and in the reverse, that from the local, there's an opportunity to reach the community and then possibly even expand into national attention. And so when you have local culture and it's reaching the local community in ways that are meaningful to the local community, you know, the concept is that we've got a public forum that increases that solidarity and recognition locally.
So kind of jumping ahead to this kind of loose network of affiliated stations under the NPR umbrella, I understand that Northern Colorado and Wyoming played a unique role in generating the name National Public Radio. I believe it was the University of Wyoming president who proposed that, who organized and secured funding for this first regional public radio coalition in the West. I just had no idea that we were in a region that was so pivotal to helping envision the name of NPR. Is there a reason for that? I mean, why do you think our region was so instrumental in this?
Yeah, great. You know, Colorado turns out to be the region that created the nomenclature for public radio, because it was just called educational radio before that, there were some advocacy groups who were making arguments that non-commercial radio shouldn't have to compete for the same airwaves since it didn't have the same income. And A.G. Crane, who was the president of the University of Wyoming and also a part of an advocacy group called the National Committee for Education by Radio, had sort of gotten fed up, with the idea that you could lobby and then lose over and over and over again. So what he did was he went back to Wyoming and went to his friends in Denver, and he said, "Look, people in mining communities in the mountains deserve the same education as people in New York City. People in rural Colorado, out in Greeley, who are herding cattle and processing, also deserve the same kind of education at the end of the day after they've been working in the fields or working with the livestock or whatever." And so what we need is to streamline and standardize a model of non-commercial media that its sole purpose is to serve the public. And so he starts calling it just public radio. He calls it public broadcasting service, like PBS. And it's a response to two things. One is public as public education. It was sort of that straightforward, is it was to be a public educational service by radio. And then there's also this provision in the Communications Act that they called the public interest mandate. And that mandate was essentially that content was less important than listener interest. It's sort of that straightforward. So people, of course, wanted to hear vaudeville and Tin Pan Alley, which is why the networks were so popular, is they had these great entertainers. But he kind of inverts it and he says, well, what if a public interest just meant public good or public service? And that was part of the vision. And so we called it the Rocky Mountain Radio Council. There's just this kind of can-do attitude out here that public media has participated with, and it really emulates a lot of local Colorado culture.
Indeed. Well, I realize your book is geared toward media scholars, but if there is one thing that you would want us, non-academic folks to take away from it, what would that be?
Yeah, I think, the idea that we have a public and that the public should be something that everyone can contribute to requires that we can't have a third party or a private interest dictating those rules to us. And I think that's what especially local media does so importantly. You take public media and its ability to just commit to journalism for the local community in ways that national media is no longer doing, is it took about 50 years to actually build public media. The networks, the commercial networks, were built in about 2 or 3 years, out because they had tons of money and they had lots of talent out in New York and New Jersey. And public media is this kind of reflexive story of this big idea, about equal access to education, and then all of the little intricacies and all the little steps that it took to actually make it true. And it's barely funded. It's about $3 per person per year, and yet it still produces the most substantial localism of any media in the US.
Josh Shepard, thank you so much for joining me today. This is so fascinating to me. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for us today here on In the NoCo. We'll be back with you tomorrow with more of what's happening in Northern Colorado. Ariel Lavery produced and mixed this episode. I'm your host, Erin O'Toole. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.